March 3, 1968, Martin Luther King delivered his last speech at the Mason Temple in Memphis, Tennessee.
We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King was assassinated at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. 23 years later, the National Civil Rights Museum was unveiled, and it has continued unabated to showcase and teach the history and legacy of civil rights, from the arrival of the first slaves on the shore of America to lynchings, sit-ins, the Freedom Riders, Rosa Parks in Birmingham, Brown versus Board of Education, and the perpetuation of Jim Crow today. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. Come along and join Faith Morris, Chief Marketing and External Affairs Officer at the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, Tennessee.
It's my job to make sure that everyone knows what this museum is about.
Approaching from the outside, it's like a trip back in time. This is at the Lorraine Motel.
It is.
And from the outside, as you're walking up, it looks literally frozen in time, and one would think that there's still motel rooms inside those doors.
We have folks that come that want to get a room, and we've kept the hotel side has a thing about steaks, and because there was a restaurant there then, and people trying to make reservations. Those are artifacts, and that's what make the museum experience as close to the real experience as possible. We really want you to live it as they
and
live
feel
it.
Feel it, yeah.
Yes.
And you even have the vintage cars parked
the
out there.
The ones right under the balcony, yes, and that's where they were then.
Mm-hmm. Gives you the shivers.
It does.
So again, to clarify a little more structurally, the facade is as it was, but on the other side of the wall, it is no longer. It's a museum and a showcase and a multi-purpose facility.
In 1991, the museum was created as a monument to Dr. King. But, you know, as we went through it, we knew it was more important to do more than that. So this building, this facade, this institution, this museum started out of tragedy because of Dr. King's death. And we built the museum around the Lorraine Motel intentionally, because the Lorraine is a sacred place. It's where Dr. King was assassinated. It was where he lived his final days, his final hours. It's where he made great impact on Memphis and the world, and that he really gave hope to the future about what could be done just based on how he lived his life and how he encouraged others. When we really try to take his platform and make it live within our visitors.
And there is a freshness and a palpable feel to being here, and yet you're approaching the 50th anniversary of his assassination.
It's amazing that it's been 50 years, especially when we look around and just see the progress or lack thereof in some instances over the past 50 years. Dr. King, 50 years ago, was really a different man. You know, he was beyond the dreamer at this point. when you ask folks about Dr. King, they will quickly go to his I Have a Dream speech when he was talking about his babies, you know, being able to live among everyone else as equal citizens. Well, certainly that is still important. But he also went beyond that. He was a lot more aggressive in his final years. He had done a lot.
Give an example of his aggressiveness.
Well, he had already done the Civil Rights Act. He had worked really heavily with Johnson, with President Johnson on that, and that wasn't an easy thing. He had pushed the Voting Rights Act. They were in Selma, but there was Freedom Summer and the Mississippi movement that happened before Selma. So he had pushed and motivated, you know, a nation to really help get that done. But he still found that there was high poverty. People were not living well still. Blacks were still struggling.
And a lot of that had to do with the absence of job opportunity, right?
Absence of jobs or quality of job. It wasn't that some weren't working, but they still were working and not getting a living wage. They were still at the poverty level.
And there's another level that my travels through the South, you learn there's that inequity in education, in the public education, all that Jim Crow. So you're already crippled before you're out of high school.
You're absolutely crippled. You're crippled before you get there. Families have been suffering through because of that lack of actually just understanding that human beings all need to be able to survive. They need to live. They should have quality of life. That's what he fought his whole life. We need to have jobs. We need to be able to feed our children. We need to have decent housing. We need to have justice. You know, folks were getting jailed for things that people just didn't have to be jailed for, just to be able to speak their minds and fight for the right to vote and to be in a hotel, you know, public places. To be able to speak. He talked a lot about the 14th Amendment. You know, the Constitution really does lay out very clearly what this country was supposed to be doing. So he would push, you know, here it is. The law exists, but it's not being enforced. And that was really what he was pushing. He pushed against war. You know, he was not for the Vietnam War. He felt that war, even more than other things, was crippling the family, tearing families apart. It almost had the same kind of effect that slavery did. I mean, the heads of the families were gone. The male children were gone because of war.
Let's go back in time. It's April 1968, and he wasn't hanging out here. He had just arrived here, right, in Memphis.
He had come the day before, yes, he had been here. And he had come, he'd been here before. It wasn't his first time in Memphis, and he'd been here a few times because he was trying to help the sanitation workers get better wages. They were working long hours with very poor pay, the conditions that they were under. They could not be inside the garbage truck. They had to be on the back. You know, folks used to think that they, you know, that's where they wanted to be hanging out. No, that's where they had to be.
Wow.
Regardless of weather, regardless of anything, it didn't matter. And when two sanitation workers were killed because they were trying to get out of the weather and they were crushed.
They were hiding under the overhang,
right. And the city just couldn't take it anymore. The sanitation workers couldn't take it anymore. Memphis was really not a union town, so they were not listening about them trying to be unionized. So it was a tough fight. And he came to lead that effort and help AFSCME.
And this was almost a spur of the moment, a last minute request, wasn't planned way in advance, right?
Well, no, it was definitely planned. His speech was not planned. It was planned for him to come. In fact, he was organizing the Poor People's March that was supposed to happen the day after. And of course, that didn't happen because he was assassinated before. But he absolutely came here to mobilize this city to support the sanitation workers and others that were in that same position. And the Poor People's March was really dedicated to them to bring some attention to the dire conditions and situations that people were living in.
And after his death, there was kind of a void in gaining a momentum, like even the creation of this facility.
Well, people were stunned. They were paralyzed. They couldn't believe it. They felt hopeless and helpless.
And this was for a while, right?
This was for a long while. Wow. There was a garbage strike, so there was garbage piled up. And Memphis has always been a beautiful city. Well, it wasn't so beautiful during that time. You had the Black Mondays where, you know, the children in the schools were supposed to be closed because of what was going on.
Explain Black Monday.
Black Monday, it was really in honor of what had happened to Dr. King. So folks were being encouraged to keep their kids out of school, and it was just a testament to the times. It was a testament. It was a way. There weren't a lot of things that people could do, and so they came up with the things that they could, and that was one. The Lorraine Motel went down. Nobody wanted to stay here. You know, it was a thriving motel, and then after he was assassinated, folks didn't want to stay here. They wanted to just come and pay their respects and honor. So the Lorraine went into foreclosure.
As an aside, it was a modern architecturally.
It was a big deal. Yeah. It was a big deal. We've started this event called Night at the Lorraine to remind people that if you were anybody coming through Memphis, you stayed at the Lorraine if you were Black, certainly.
Not segregated motel, right?
Well, it was one of the few that Blacks and whites could congregate. It was one of the few where you could actually socialize at the pool together. Mm-hmm. It was in the Green Book, and there were just a few hotels along the interstate that you could stop.
There are people that don't know what the Green Book is or was. Talk about that for a moment.
Well, because there were so few places, so few public places that allowed Blacks to come in to eat, to sleep, there needed to be a listing of those that would allow it. So that was the Green Book. And they circulated that throughout, you know, organizations in the community. So
if you were traveling cross-country,
that was the Bible.
And if you did not have that, you were blind.
It was an experiment for sure, because you would be knocking on a lot of doors that didn't let you in.
Yeah.
Or they would put you in a trailer in the back. When I was a child, I had no idea. We went to Tucumcari in New Mexico. And I didn't know we couldn't stay in the hotel. We ended up staying in a trailer in the back. Well, I thought it was the coolest thing.
You were like a kid.
But it wasn't so cool, and I grew up to know why we were back there. Mm-hmm. But that was the story, is that the doors were not open to Black travelers. And so, like I say, the movement was very strategic and very resourceful. Made a way out of no way in many instances, and that was one. When you go through the museum, you see the storytelling around the Freedom Riders, who it was probably one of the toughest things. They would bomb those buses going up and down the interstate. They were jailed at any given moment. But their quest was really to, one, bring attention to the discrimination that was happening and the limitations that Blacks had in just movement. No buses, no hotels, no restaurants, so.
As you're talking, my mind's going here and there in the past and present. And over the last 50 years, there has been progress. There really has. That you can come into a hotel in Tucumcari and have reasonable expectations. But on another level, another dimension, things that Martin Luther King were fighting for, voting rights, for example, a lot of those things are still hugely problematic, and it's almost eerie how a half a century later things have not changed.
Well, the civil rights movement was one of the most successful movements. There was major, major accomplishments in that there was a Civil Rights Act. And there were so many amendments to the Civil Rights Act because they still wouldn't enforce the first one. So they'd make the next one tougher, and then they'd make the next one tougher. Teddy Kennedy did one of the last ones. He said, now look, you know, this is crazy. This is a document, a doctrine that we need to be following. I'm going to make sure we have some stuff in there that folks have to do. The Voting Rights Act was during that time. When you look at folks still having infringements of their civil rights, when you look at even with the last election, people not being able to vote, voting rights is still such a huge issue.
And one would have thought that we'd be past that.
You would think. You would think. I guess the thing that is the toughest is that it's a human thing. Mm-hmm. Well, here's the thing, that disproportionately, people of color and people in poverty are the ones that get the biggest hit. They're the ones that
easy target for one.
Easy target, yes. You know, because they don't have a lot of alliances. And so when you see folks, children, students, I mean, the ones that have the least representation are the ones that are the easiest targets.
Yeah, for sure. And they don't have the money, which is the power.
And that's the reason that so many of them are incarcerated for things that they shouldn't be incarcerated for.
Yeah. Well, let's go back for a moment to the National Civil Rights Museum here, which is an outgrowth of everything we've been talking about. And you have a moment, we can take a quick little walk and show us.
So, you know, when we talk about, you know, how hard it was for folks to get around, and we'll go through and see the Freedom Riders exhibit. But one of the things that happened with the Freedom Riders is that because they didn't know they were coming back, they never knew. They would make sure they got their affairs in order before they got on the bus.
So they knew when they
knew that it was a tough thing. It was probably one of the most deadly ones of any of them because they were such a target for bombings. So you'll see when we get to the Freedom Riders exhibit, the bombed bus. It's a Greyhound, for sure, yeah.
Let's take a quick look. Faith, one more time, when did this open?
1991 is when the National Civil Rights Museum was born, was launched, was opened. So we celebrated our 25th anniversary last year.
So where are we now?
It's called A Culture of Resistance. This is about the slavery movement in America from 1619 to 1861. And there's so little about slavery that this world knows, you know, understanding that men and women were brought over as kings and queens. They knew very little about this country. They were considered prominent and educated. When they got here, they were separated. Their families were destroyed. There's an exhibit here that shows you kind of the conditions that they were in when they did the Middle Passage on the slave ships. They died on them. They had babies on them. They, you know, they went through all the physical conditions that you can imagine. And they had to endure that together as they took that long trip. But one of the things that folks also don't understand is that slavery lasted 366 years. There were 12.5 million Africans that were a part of slavery. Also don't understand why it was such an important institution, because it was the backbone of the economy. Every significant commerce was supported through the manpower that slavery generated. So when there was this threat to get rid of it, that's where the revolution came from, right? Because it really was something that was going to impact the economy. So I love this exhibit because it really does set the tone and start the story on the first civil rights infringements that we can really talk about. It was truly when Africans were brought here.
Very powerful.
When we leave this exhibit, we're going to go through Jim Crow. And we get the question all the time, you know, who was Jim Crow? And we tell them it's not a man. It's an oppressive set of laws. You know, it probably felt very human because it was very personal, all of the things that, you know, through Jim Crow you couldn't do.
Jim Crow is still operative today.
Well, absolutely it is. We don't call it Jim Crow except for folks trying to make you understand historically what Jim Crow is. But if you really peel back the essence of Jim Crow, it was just the barring of civil rights. Mm-hmm. That you didn't have equitable opportunities, that you were not able to enjoy what the Constitution said you should be able to, that every man and woman and child should be able to enjoy. It was their right to be able to have these things under the law. And so the Constitution has come up so much in the last little bit, because people are really fighting back. And these are multiracial. I mean, this is across every line because nothing is sacred right now. Everybody is being threatened for one reason or the other because of their religious persuasion or their sexual persuasion or their race, creed, color, all of that, you know, is under attack. So we go back to the Constitution to have some kind of foundation, some kind of platform for what really they should be able to have. But it was also during Jim Crow that so many things did happen. It was the renaissance of the arts, and you had a lot of black press that started, a lot of black schools started. Arts and entertainment was at its highest. Doctors and lawyers and folks were starting to really own their own land. And there was still disparity between black labor and white wealth. Mm-hmm. And there was still the issue of voting. There's one in here that you just can't get past where it says it's a lynching. And across him, it says this nigger voted. And if that doesn't tell you what was going on during that time. So we're not at this right now, although there have been a few lynchings here lately. They're not being lynched like they were. There's a phenomenal story around lynching that, you know, ought to delve into a little bit. It's the psychology of it and what happens with it. But folks went through a lot just to vote. But it was really during this time that there was this resurgence of all kinds of things that happened that had just not been a part of the equation until now. What's really clear is that there is still an attitude of privilege. There is an attitude of barring communities and races of people and cultures from just the day-to-day rights that people should enjoy. And we're hoping that we're not seeing more of that. One thing that has happened in, you know, this past year is that folks who probably have been silent before are rising up because they're seeing that there is some work that needs to be done. It reminds you so much of what was going on in the 50s and 60s when the nation was made aware of what was happening in the movement when Dr. King brought journalists in so they could really see and report.
Can you talk a little bit more deeper on that subject? Because that really was the game changer, wasn't it?
It was. Mm-hmm. And he knew that. He knew that. The work that they would do would only impact one community. And it would keep going and keep going, keep going. Because
people in another state wouldn't even know what's going on.
People down the road didn't know what's going on. So he made sure that the New York Times and other major media, he made sure that the networks came to Birmingham. It was called Bombingham, you know, because, you know, they didn't call it terrorism then, but it was terrorism what was happening to people within the movement. And after that, there were so many broadcasts and so many stories that the nation, you know, was in mourning for their country. Because they just didn't know that that kind of hate was happening. And then they really tried to do something. So folks traveled in droves. They took cars and trucks and buses. But they got to the South to really try to help. And the other thing that was clear is that it really did diversify the movement more. When you look at mugshots, because that's in some ways the best place to catch her, because so many of the folks that were helping with the movement were arrested. But it's a very diverse picture. It's of every color, and it just shows you humanity. You know, when folks know that that kind of, it's something that is this awful is happening, people do rise up to try to help. And he knew that human factor would have to kick in, and he was right.
Let's talk a little bit more about the National Civil Rights Museum as a teaching tool for the young kids coming up, because that seems to be the most important dynamic.
We are definitely a teaching museum, an education resource. We want to help educators, and they come to us so often to be able to use this storytelling to help in their teaching for a few reasons. One is that these stories are not in the books. The books are very minimal in what they talk about the civil rights movement. Yes, everybody knows about Dr. King, but very few know about Fannie Lou Hamer. They don't even know about Bayard Rustin, who was gay and behind a lot and who was barred because he was gay, because that just would have been too hard to deal with his persuasion and try to make some. So he was behind the scenes a lot.
Well, even behind you, some of these photos are so illuminating as to the historic roots of activism. And can you talk about some of the photos that are here?
You know, some of them are stories within themselves. When one of the things that this new movement has adapted that was part of the old movement is that they did a lot of their storytelling in their banners and their signs. So the great part about it is that when the photographers captured it, they captured the feelings of the moment. This one is "The New Negro Has No Fear."
And that's what, 1920s it looks like.
Right, right. I mean, as far back as then, when there was still so much a need to try to fight for jobs and fight for education and fight for, you know, just minimal rights.
But that's showing basically a parade right downtown, right?
Well, let me tell you, marching and music and outside gatherings were a big deal. I mean, it was a very social movement, too. You got to know a lot of people because there were so many in need. And when they would hear that folks were congregating, they would come out, you know, and support and be a part of.
And right in front of you, it looks like Booker T. Washington on the podium.
Right.
And do you know where that was, when that was?
He really talked about Jim Crow. He was one of the first that said Jim Crow must go. And he was an educator. He was one that really pushed heavily for education. He needed to make a huge statement about how to end it. And of course, you know, he really was planning to be a politician. He gave that up so that he could really fight for what he felt was more meaningful, which was to push for the end of these oppressive laws, Jim Crow. But then this is also when W.E.B. Du Bois came on the scene. And you could consider that Booker T. Washington came from the Dr. King side of things, and W.E.B. Du Bois was more like Malcolm X. He felt that there needed to be more forceful ways to get things done. We talk about strategies for change, and there's an exhibit that does that, is that everybody had this common goal of the push for freedom and equity and rights, but they had different ways of getting it done, and that was the power of the movement. There were a lot of, because of Jim Crow, there were a lot of national associations, and that's what we talked about here with the beginning of the schools, and you had more doctors and lawyers and people pushing heavily against the whole voter attacks. It's when folks like Malcolm X was coming on the scene later, because Dr. King had one way of doing it, and you had a group that said, you know, I get the nonviolence, but Malcolm X is an eye for an eye is what we really need to do. So it's because of all those different ways of getting it done. Tuskegee Institution and Booker T. Washington. The images are so powerful when you come to the museum, just being able to be absorbed by the images. You know, we want to make sure it's not just a book on the wall. So the images and the films are some of the, you could just sit in a theater and just watch the films go and go and go.
So you have different theater venues here.
We do, throughout, because we know that when we were creating the new museum that was, you know, we renovated in 2014, one of the things that was really important, because we talked to our visitors, was that it be interactive, that it tell the story through film. We wanted to make sure that the history makers and their voices were captured, that we have authentic news coverage of what was going on. And thankfully, there was news coverage of what was going on. In Brown versus Board of Education, we wanted to really dissect it enough so folks would understand the legislative part of it that was so critical in making sure that all these movements for education would happen, and Brown just happened to be the marquee one of them. But to look on the education side and what was going on with students, what was going on with educators, we do a lot of statistics because we feel that it's important for you to know the numbers. You know, what were people living, you know, through and with? We have these smart boards, and you can push on any of them and see what was going on around the country. These are all education movements. People some only know about Brown versus Board. There were hundreds of them, hundreds. But here's something. Do the math. And this is just a comparison of blacks and white schools, that the teacher's salaries usually $200 to $300 difference.
And that would be 200 to 300% difference.
Exactly. The funding for the schools, you know, minimal for black schools. Folks just don't know. You know, some folks say, well, what's the big deal? You know, I don't get why there's such a big deal. Well, there's a huge deal, the disparity.
Well, there's 1937, 1938, public funding for college education, black funding 92% less than white,
right.
Correct?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's sobering.
There was only 8% of all funding went to black schools. The rest of it went to white schools. And if you fast forward to now, you know, what would those numbers look like?
Yeah. Pretty sobering.
Yeah. And so then we go from here to Montgomery. And, you know, we talk about the women's movement, the women's march that just happened. Well, there was a women's movement in Montgomery where women said that they were not going to ride the buses anymore. They were not going to be in the back. So they walked everywhere they went. You know, they took their children, walked their children to school. They walked to work. They walked to the grocery store. They did not ride the bus. And it created such an economic impact that the bus system was forced to do something. Well, Rosa Parks was not the first one to not give up her seat. She was chosen to be the one. One, because of her position. You know, she was secretary of the NAACP in Montgomery. She had some social status. She looked the part. But there were a number of people, two of them in fact, that came before her and kind of set the path for doing it. This one is the year they walked, you know, and how significant that was. And then we go into the sit-in exhibit. This is where we get to the trying to desegregate public places, restaurants. We all know about the Woolworth, you know, in North Carolina. But I think the most phenomenal thing here is the training that they went through. So there's the videos just showing what they trained in SNCC. These were youngsters that were in charge of this initiative. They were going from restaurant to restaurant to try to be able to desegregate. But it was amazing the things that they went through. They showed them that you cannot push back. You cannot fight back. You cannot be arrested because you are doing something. The arrest has to be only because they're not allowing you in because of your skin color.
There's some tough spirits, huh?
They were tough. I just wonder, you know, if we have the gumption to do it that way.
I was going to ask you, that's a really important question. Could that happen again today? Do the kids have the guts?
I think so. Mm-hmm. I really do think so. The ones that come through here, they really are on a mission. They ask all kinds of questions. They weren't part of this movement. They weren't even born anywhere. Their parents weren't born during this movement. But they are so inquisitive about, you know, what happened and how it happened and when it happened. And they ask, boy, you know, I don't know if I would have taken that. You know, I'm really more in the Malcolm X camp. You know, I want to fight back. Mm-hmm. But they absolutely understand once they, and it's intentional that we go into this kind of depth so that they really can see that there was a strategy behind everything that was done. You know, don't take away what is happening because you're fighting back and then it becomes about the fight and not about what you're fighting for.
In your time at the National Civil Rights Museum, you've met and interacted with a lot of kids, a lot of high school, even college age.
Oh, yeah.
What are some of the most memorable and touching things that you've observed or interacted with the kids?
Well, you know, we always think the kids have no attention span. You know, they're tied to social media. They've got their faces in their phones. And when they come in here, they're different people. Whether they came on their own or they were pushed through, and many of them are pulling their families through, which is an interesting dynamic. But when we talk to them, and they're a little quiet when they get to the end, even if they're playing around when it starts, and then all of a sudden this kind of soaks in and they start paying attention in a way that their teachers are amazed. And they are mesmerized by just watching the movement happen in front of their eyes, and to see what folks went through, and then to make the connection of what they did so that they could enjoy, so that they don't have to do it. And now they realize that we're in a different time. They're very involved in wanting to do something. You know, we talk about, you know, take a stand, act, vote. Well, this generation is very interested in that. They're giving, and they're active.
So you're encouraged. You're optimistic.
I'm very encouraged by it. Very encouraged. They are paying attention. They're fussing about what their parents did and did not do, and saying all the things that they plan to do, that they don't want to be victims of what has happened before, that they want to have more charge of their own destiny, that this encourages them when they see, you know, what the folks in the movement did just to be able to exist. And they know that's not their life right now, regardless of their economic status. They still see that they have a very big part to play.
I would love to spend the day here, and I know a person would need to do that to properly.
Absolutely. They need to come right on.
Faith Morris, thank you so much. An honor and a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. I'm so glad you were here.
It was my pleasure. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Memphis.
Gospel Music Underbed was performed by the St. Mark Baptist Church, recorded live in Little Rock, Arkansas.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com. Our associate producers include Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Kim Schneider from Michigan, Elaine Masters in San Diego, Julie Henning, Eugene, Oregon, and Steve Cook, contributing from Little Rock, Arkansas, host of Arkansongs on NPR affiliate KUAR.
In China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges, because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. And so just as I say we aren't going to let any dogs or water hoses turn us around, we aren't going to let any injunction turn us around. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.